party all to me. Let's have a big bash all to me. Let's celebrate now all to me. Another scandal all to me. That's what your vote is gonna get. Anytime you ain't seen nothing best. We're going all the way in there.
This is What's Left in Albany. Let's see. I am Dan Platt, your host, having discussions, talking about the issues that matter here in Albany to have a better understanding of how things work and to better understand the world so we can change it, particularly thinking under the rubric of think globally, act locally. But you also sometimes think locally as well, because otherwise that motto means have an ideology, have a worldview, think about how you're changing the whole world, systems perhaps, but then take action where you can. To change everything, start anywhere. And I'm starting with community media. So I'm Dan Platt, your neighborhood eco-socialist, waging my one-man campaign against confusion and opaque systems of governance. And I'm doing that this week with an episode which will probably stay evergreen, depending on how I edit it. But I have been reading the, provided by Urban Aftermath Bookshop, Mayor Corning's biography, subtitled Albany Icon, Albany Enigma by Paul Grondahl. And so this is after also reading about a year or so ago, O Albany by William Kennedy, which is one of those standard A History of Albany or General Albany books from, and all of these books are written by former Times Union journalists. These are the people who write about Albany and what's going on in it on a daily or weekly basis. So they're pretty knowledgeable. They talk to the most people, but then they have that type of writing style that is, well, journalistic, right? It's not a history book, not academic. It's not really informed by having a social history, though that's kind of something William Kennedy was trying to do. And his chapter on the Albany politics and the machine left something to be desired for me. There is a whole book about the political machine by somebody who was a critic of it in the 60s and early, wrote it in the 70s. So it was still kind of kicking, and he went much deeper. But I don't want to read a whole book on the air. And it's also a book I've yet to read, though, of course, it's on my list. But at the moment, I'm reading Corning's biography, which is, of course, more personal biography, which I'm skipping most of that because that's just not what I'm interested in, right? I have a special interest, and that is Albany politics, how things really work. Because growing up, it was all very confusing to me how anything really happened. And there's the ways activists operate, which always seems kind of confused, or is this going to work? This has worked for us, that's why we do it. We've been doing it for 30 years. But then it's not really making a systemic impact. You're just kind of helping or preventing one disaster at a time, you know, one demolished building or saving one building at a time. And this is kind of how I was introduced to being an architect in school, that you make the world better one design at a time. And this is just too slow for me. I want to think bigger. I want to act bigger because the problems we have are big. Homelessness is not solved one little house rehab at a time. If it were, it would have been solved decades ago. It would have been solved when activists or people like my parents started doing it in the 80s. But well, you know it, the city has hundreds of still 1,000 vacant buildings, which has been reduced by maybe 100, but then there's another 900 to go. And if we're on the same track of we're fixing 100 buildings a year. Meanwhile, another 200 go delinquent or abandoned or are literally demolished by the city. Well, then we still have a hollowed out or underbuilt city. So I've talked and will talk at length, episode to episode, with this program about the issues of Albany. Now, I want to deep into the how and to understand Albany's history, at least in the 20th century, which is what this covers. We have a very durable political machine in the city, and it lasted for at least counting officially 75 years. So let's get into Chapter 5, The Never-Ending Story, Dan and Erasmus and Their Durable Machine. So this is the Mayor Corning documentary. Mayor Corning was mayor of Albany for 42 years, from 1941 to 1983. With each election, his the number of votes he won with kind of went down by 3,000. So it's kind of interesting. You can kind of see either the political apathy grow decade to decade, as well as Albany's population shrinking under his tutelage. But that's more to the last chapter. So I'm kind of going to read this chapter, and then another week I'll read the kind of conclusionary chapter about his legacy, which is kind of underwhelming at the very least. So every chapter, like most of these kind of books, open with a quote, "For some reason, it brought back an expression that Dan O'Connell had: all dogs are nicer than most people." So this is an undated note from Mayor Erastus Corning II to wildlife artist Wayne Trim, who was finishing a wolf painting for the mayor. And it goes through chapter by chapter how the mayor was quite the conservationist slash, you know, nature lover, as many patricians like him, old money types. So I think before I go through here, I just need to explain something that this is chapter 5. One chapter goes into the Corning family. They're old money, they're WASS, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and they built fortunes, Scrooge McDuck level fortunes, through the industrialization of America, right? The robber barons, kind of robber baron activity. In this case, the Cornings, they had the iron works. The iron works made the railroad ties, so they own quite a lot of railroad, and if you own the railroads, it's like having a monopoly of all commerce. And so it goes. So they have money. His great-grandfather was also a mayor. The Cornings built some of the nice architecture of Albany. Doesn't have their name on it, but they built it. What are some things that the Cornings built? Well, this book goes into quite a lot of it. And it's always kind of surprising, because it's not like they all have plaques saying so. It's kind of weird that they didn't really plaster their name on everything. Corning has two things named after him: the tower and the riverfront. Those two things. And they were named pretty much not after he died. The preserve was named like in his last years, and then the tower was named, I think, the year after he died or so. Why? Because he's a tall guy and the tower's tall. Makes sense. Now that starts the reading. "During the denouncement of the dance of death, that is cockfighting, I also have to go into, I'm going to be using the word cock a lot. It's referring to male roosters. All right, I'm getting that out of the way. And why? What does cockfighting have to do with anything? So maybe if I say it a weird way, like a Boston cockfight. Anyway, "It's claw fitted with a razor sharp piece of metal known as a slasher, begins clawing and pecking and shredding the other animal into oblivion in a crazed whirl of feathers and blood and primal savagery. This eruption of heart-stopping violence is rewarded with lusty applause from the spectators. This is what they come to witness and to wager on, this ultimate act of aggression. It is considered very bad form for the rooster's owner or spectator to be so gripped by a twinge of remorse that he would enter the ring to halt the carnage and the losing cock's certain annihilation. Cockfighting, after all, is a blood sport that is meant to be a fight to the death. Two roosters enter the ring. Only one leaves victorious and in one piece. The match goes on until one of the birds is maimed or killed. The analogy between cockfighting and politics, as practiced in its most ferocious atavistic form, is an obvious one. The Albany Democratic machine was formed by two families, the Cornings and the O'Connells, whose bond to politics was a link of blood, the blood of cockfighting. Little did it matter that cockfighting was illegal in New York, as was gambling on the outcome. With newly won cash in the pockets and blood still on their lips, in some instances, quite literally, since maimed gamecocks might anoint those in the front row with their mortal wounds. The Cornings and the O'Connells would repair to O'Connell's saloon to drink ale and talk politics and cockfighting. A perennial Albany question has been this. How did the aristocratic Cornings and the working-class O'Connells, Irish, even get together and stay together? Pundits and political scientists wanted to find some metaphysical explanation. You know, class dynamics or something like that. I mean, I come from it from a Marxist. By the way, I'm going to be giving a little commentary here and there when I'm not doing my reading voice. Can you tell the difference? I don't know. It came down to an extraditable mix of beer and the blood sport of fighting chickens and politics. Theirs was an alliance more profane than sublime, but it was a winning combination. The democratic political machine fashioned by the O'Connells and Cornings seized power in Albany, seized power, appropriate terms, in 1929. And by the way, throughout this, I want you to be thinking about what it means to have democracy in America. Every now and then, I'm hearing about how our democracy is under threat. And I think about what democracy in America of the 20th century means. Picking between two billionaires? Does it mean living in a one-party state or city like Albany? Think about that question of what democracy means to you as an ideal and what it is in practice in America, throughout American history. Despite a substantial erosion of its sphere of influence and power amid a cluster of major Republican victories, it continues to shape the city and county politics in the waning years of the 20th century with remnants of the old committeeman and ward leader hierarchy. But subtext, this book was published in 1996. I was 7 years old. Okay. That's more than three quarters of a century of Democratic domination. The machine lives on today in vestigial forms, reverent of its patron saints, even though there have been no O'Connells or Cornings involved for more than a decade. The machine's eight-decade dynasty is unprecedented in American political history. The O'Connell-Corning organization has endured longer than any other fabled political machine and its boss, longer than Tweed in New York, Curley in Boston, Pendergrast in Kansas City, Long in Louisiana, Buckley in San Fran, Hogg in Jersey City, Crump in Memphis, Dennison in Omaha, Aldridge in Rochester, John Gunfer, and he left out the dailies of Chicago. Rochester, let's see, John Gunfer described Albany's form of government in a memorable phrase, resonant in definition both as sewer and the defecation and procreation cavity of birds and reptiles. In his 1947 book, Inside USA, as, quote, a kind of political cloaca maxima, beside which Kansas City seemed almost pure. In international terms, you might call it a draw regarding the duration of communist rule in the Soviet Union and the O'Connell-Corning machine. Both the Bolsheviks and the O'Connells and Cornings seized power at roughly the same time in the World War I era. And 7 decades later, each began to break apart in the early 1980s, with the death of Corning in 1983 in Albany and the emergence of Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika reforms in Russia that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall. That is a great simplification, but so does this kind of writing. Moving on. In the Albany County Democratic Committee, a few cogs of the machine's dictatorial powers appear durable enough to survive into the 21st century. Wink, wink. The Albany machine, quote, the Albany machine is a dinosaur, the Jurassic Park of American politics, said John Tieford, a professor of political science at Purdue. The author of books on urban politics and Boss Tweed, quote, Albany's political structure has changed only at a geological pace. It's remarkable how long it has survived. Albany is boss land. You couldn't name a city in the world in which, in this century, that has had the same political organization in power as long as Albany. Warren Moscow, the erstwhile New York Times reporter, marveled at the timelessness of the O'Connell-Corning machine in his definitive 1948 text, Politics in the Empire State. Quoting him, the Albany machine is probably closest to the ideal of the practical political machine, Moscow wrote. It more nearly resembles the old-type Tammany organization of Murphy's day than any other extant. It is a prototype of the Irish Democratic Organization so familiar in the cities of the North, but is much better than most now in existence. It has the vices of entrenched paternalism and plenty of the practical virtues as well. But good or bad, the people of Albany like it. Moscow listed the machine's vices, from pressuring Albany saloon keepers to put the O'Connell's family ale and lager stocked, their brand, Hendrick's, on tap, to assessment tampering, to giving municipal contract to its no-bid friends, to the detriment of the taxpayer. Quote, "The boss system made money for the boss and the party organization," Moscow wrote, "but it also made life more bearable for a lot of little people who had no other access otherwise to the government, who knew of its operations only through their contacts with the machine." So I note this is kind of how I view a lot of people's relationship with their council person. Their council person is there to be the facilitator between government services and them. It's like, oh, you have a problem? Well, I'll know who to call in city services to get your tree cut down or the water, you know, this or that. At least that's what I see on the campaign trail when I talk to, well, why do you like your council person? Oh, they did me this favor. They got me this done. It's never something policy oriented. So they all, sometimes it is, but whatever. So the Albany machine infested every facet of life, legal or otherwise, noted Samuel Friedman in his 96 book, The Inheritance, How Three Families in America Moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and Beyond. Quote, "More than anything, if you wanted a job, you mortgaged your vote. The O'Connell version of patronage was like public works without the work." O'Friedman wrote, "The O'Connell coining machine is America's most durable urban machine. Albany is, in many ways, the archetypical machine city." M. Craig Brown wrote in a chapter titled Machine Politics in the anthology Experiencing Albany, a book that I've yet to find listed anywhere. Brown, a former sociology professor at the State University of New York at Albany, he's at SUNY, wrote a government-funded study quantifying the distribution of political machines across cities and over time in America. Nothing came close to Albany. "What is it about this city that lends itself to the inertia of dominance?" Brown asked. He concluded the answer remained a riddle. What is clear is that Albany's machine in the 1980s resembled political machines elsewhere in the U.S. from the 1890s. Dan and Erasmus, a couple of old fossils resurrecting a dinosaur. It's one for the history books, to be sure. And its lineage can be traced to the blood sport of cackfighting and the drinking culture of the saloon. The O'Connell coining machines, and saloon really is just bar, but let's just say it's pre-prohibition bar. So I suppose a saloon is like an unregulated bar. Perhaps that's the way of putting it. The O'Connell coining machine's extraordinary strength and durability is due to the forged early union between working class immigrants and upper class aristocrats. It was this potent union that Erasmus, as mayor for life, was to play a significant and ceaseless role. The initial and fertile common ground between these two classes was the cockfighting ring. Daniel Peter O'Connell, the archetypical part political boss, was born on... So now this next page is his early story. He's the archetypical political boss. He was born on November 13th of 1885. It was Friday the 13th, and his father, John Blackjack O'Connell, ran a saloon at 4th Avenue and South Pearl Street. Okay. I think that's where the Family Dollar is. His mother, Mary Doyle O'Connell, bore and raised four sons who went on to give birth to the political machine and the likes of which this country likely will never witness again. The O'Connell boys possessed a winning combination of fearlessness, intelligence, and ambition. They soon became a dominant force in Albany's South End, an ethnic melting pot of newly arrived immigrants, particularly Irish, Germans, Italians, and Jews. Dan spent a large part of his formative years at the family saloon, having quit formal schooling after the fifth grade. Keep in mind, this is the 1890s. There was also an economic depression happening in that decade as well. But regardless, he quit school in fifth grade. But he pursued his education outside the classroom. At the bar, Dan learned how to speak fluent German with the immigrant patrons, a connection he would later exploit for votes cast in favor of Dan's machine candidates. Dan moved out beyond... This reminds me, by the way, of we have a small but, you know, sizable Russian-speaking population. And, you know, if you speak Russian, you earn their votes. Let's see. Dan moved out beyond his turf in the South End and gained influence across the city with an amateur football club team he managed, the Delphinians. Dan used the opportunity of traveling football games to solidify a blue-collar social network throughout Albany County that sowed the seeds of the future political machine far and wide. So that's usually a theme I see, is you use some kind of social activity to build up a social network. Oh, what do you mean about that? Social networking. And then power results. And that's, but that's sort of also the story, the non-economic base, the non-Marxist story, where you ignore kind of class struggle, to say that power flows from those who have the most friends. So you just build up your social network. If you're really extroverted, if you're good at organizing things like football games, you make the most friends, and those friends get you, well, boons of some kind, or political power. You can leverage that, or you leverage it in business. All those people become your customers if you're a small business owner. If you're a big business owner, your community then are other semi-rich people, and then you leverage that. And speaking as an introvert, you know, that kind of makes me kind of mad at the inequality. It's like, is all inequality in this world just between the extroverts lording over the introverts who aren't good at organizing and don't and aren't doing sports, the nerds? You know, that's why, you know, so the tech revolution is so important. Now the nerds are in charge, and now they get to muddle about and be the celebrities, even though they're super cringe and not likable. And then they have to buy Twitter so people like them. But that's a very deterministic way of viewing the world, and I don't like it. So that's why I kind of go for more neo-Marxism of looking at class and who owns the money and who's really running the businesses, who has the ability to build these social networks. But it's interesting to see how, of course, working people can also do all of that and build their own power. But in this case, they built up working class power, and then they basically made a deal with the old money Protestants, the you know, who, if there was the South, they would be the plantation owners. But up here, they're factory owners. It's the same kind of business. Wage labor, slave labor. Where I left off. Although he was not a polished public speaker, Dan compensated for a raspy, squeaky, high-pitched voice through a squat, barrel-chested physique that lent him the forcefulness of a fireplug and a rough-hewn charisma that burned brightly in brown eyes exaggerated behind thick bifocals. Dan eventually took over bartending duties from his father, who also schooled him in the finer points of gamecock breeding, raising, and fighting. Quote, Black Jack O'Connell had trained fighting cocks in Ireland, and he passed on his skills to Dan. This is from John E. Holt Harris, Jr., a patrician Albany attorney and the city recorder court judge who had a lifelong association with the Cornings, or both families. By the way, any person mentioned in this chapter is going to have some kind of relevant city or county job. Keep lookout for that. It kind of becomes a mess and overwhelming. I'll try slowing down, or anyway. Holt Harris, he comes up a lot. But anyway, he also says, the patricians like Edwin Corning, the mayor's father, would come into O'Connell's saloon. The O'Connells got the Cornings interested in cockfighting, and that was the entry into O'Connell's, the Albany's patrician world. Down through the generations, the Cornings have liked their drink, and despite their Episcopalian reserve, the descendants of the original Erastus needed no coaxing to take a walk on the wild side. This is, after all, like the fourth generation after the one that built, well, not built, but funded the factory. And where did they come from? They came from, like, Connecticut. They're Yankees. Where did their wealth come from? Who knows? Whaling, something weird, something exploitative, something that built America. Mixing with the O'Connell boys, who came to be considered the lords of the South End, represented a symbolic crossover to the other side of the tracks for the Cornings. At the turn of the century, the world of the Cornings was the WASP conclave of wealth and privilege around Elk Street, a patrician neighborhood surrounded by the city's great architecture, the old Albany Academy, City Hall, and the Capitol. This was the domain of bankers and industrialists, physicians and lawyers, permeated by the culture of old money. About one block of it remains, the one that's facing Academy Park. So you can kind of look at that, at the, you know, what, whoa, these look really nice, those row houses. Well, that's where the millionaires live, folks. And also Tenbrook Triangle, that's also called, used to be Millionaires Row. You can kind of see they're very nice row houses. when they were renovated. The Cornings had all the comforts of a millionaire could buy, but they didn't have the visceral, illicit pleasure of the cockfight. Holt Harris, and this is why Teddy Roosevelt, you know, was founded the park system, you know, going out into the woods and hunting and all that, you know. Holt Harris, born in 1917, is a son of a politically connected physician who was appointed city bactericologist, something like a health inspector, health official. One of the elder Holt Harris patients happened to be Mayor Corning's father. Holt Harris's son, the judge, was familiar with cockfighting from the aristocratic vantage point since boyhood. Quote, "The patricians became addicted to cockfighting," Holt Harris said. "They all owned fighting cocks, especially the Cornings. The Cornings had a big fighting cock operation. Wealth couldn't ensue success in the blood sport, though. Cockfighting was a great social equalizer." Quote, "Cockfighting brought together the lower and upper classes like few other things. It was a poor man's sport because anyone could afford to breed, raise, and groom a rooster. And it also became a passion for the gentry who enjoyed the challenge of breeding a line of champion fighting cocks as they had with dogs and horses." Since the mid-19th century, when Erastus Corning Jr., what, going up to Saratoga and whipping the horses wasn't good enough for them anymore? Well, they needed something a little closer, I guess. So since the mid-19th century, when Erastus Corning the Jr., the mayor's grandfather, began to amass his world-class collection of orchids, butterflies, moths, and so on, the Cornings were drawn to the mysteries of early genetic engineering. Fighting cocks were no different. In the early years of the 20th century, you know, everyone was into eugenics at the time. Everybody. And his brother Parker, young and rising industrialist, divided the vast acreage of the Corning estate in Glenmont on Corning Hill. I guess that's the side of Glenmont that's, if you go along Route 32, not all the way, but before 32 turns up the hill towards Del Mar, if you keep going, apparently that's Corning Hill there. I was taking a look at it the other day. The mayor's father, Edwin Corning, raised Irish wolfhounds as a hobby and had two champions of the breed at his estate. He interested Dan O'Connell in the breed, and many later visitors to the home of the political boss on Whitehall Road recalled being jumped up on and nearly knocked over by Dan's pair of Irish wolfhounds. The boss, with an iron-fisted disciplinarian with ward heelers, that's with two E's, it seemed, but a softy when it came to draining his dogs. The Corning brothers, Parker and Edwin, also each employed a crew of farmhands to raise their animals and their fighting cocks to the highest standards, so they weren't really doing the work. Of course, they can't dirty their hands with chicken feathers. Come on. They got banks to run. So cockfighting could mean big money for those who raised the most vicious, murderous roosters. "There is some heavy wagering," said Holt Harris, who spoke from experience. Dan O'Connell told William Kennedy in a 1974 interview recounted in Old Albany that he, Dan, beat Gus Melick. Okay, I don't care. So wagering on cockfighting was a double criminal offense, and the mains, as the matches were called, required an underground quality. The location of the upcoming main was revealed only to insiders, the secret society of cockfighters and bettors. Bringing a man into the ring, the secret society is not the last time that will be mentioned as a thing. So the ring of lawbreakers involved an unwritten oath of loyalty, a blood oath, as it were. This loyalty, the Cornings and the O'Connells later utilized as the foundation of their political dynasty. Charlie Ryan, one of Dan's closest friends, told Kennedy, "Dan said he'd never trust a politician with anything, but he would trust a chicken fighter with his life." At the main, there were lookouts, a bookmaker, and the ring judge. O'Connell hosted some of Albany's biggest and richest cockfights at his summer home on Beaver Dam Road in the Helderbergs, just above Thatcher Park. It wasn't called Thatcher Park at the time, though. Or was it? Maybe it was. Thatcher was mayor in the 1920s. So I saw a couple of fights up at Dan's summer place. There were a lot of men. Some were, like me, more curious than devotees of that kind of thing. O'Connell flouted the law by hiring George Kenfield, an Albany police sergeant, to handle the fighting cocks. O'Connell estimates he had 500 fighting roosters at a time. "Perhaps the best in the world," he told Kennedy. Holy Harris said that was hardly hyperbole. Dan's chickens had notoriety among aficionados as far away as the Philippines. They were called the Albany strain. They were very valuable and in demand as breeding stock. The cock fights were Dan's stage as much as a political arena. Dan would narrate the chicken fights, a bunch of meaningless terms to me, said Judge Francis Bergen, who attended several of these matches. The Cornings were major cockfighters, and they were joined by a lot of wealthy Albany people. Without cockfighting, there would be no connection between the O'Connells and their friends and the Cornings and theirs. So it wasn't base class or self-interest. It was something as weird as cockfighting. But maybe that's just one side of the story, and the economic analysis is, it's all left out of this. I need like an economic or like a social history of Albany to, that discusses class dynamics. But as far as that, I had to intuit or in like put it in myself from my knowledge of how things work and the general social history of America. Because Albany, because of the machine, it seems completely isolated from it. You know, there's a joke between me and other people I know that's like we're 15 years behind everybody else. If a city like South Bend is doing something interesting, we'll be doing it 15 years later. Or like it was in the early 90s that some cities were building convention centers and it was making the money. So, of course, in the, by the mid-aughts, 15 years later, Albany is talking about and the state's planning to build a convention center. And then it takes another 12 years to actually build it, the one on Eagle Street, the Capitol Center. Bergen, born in 1902, this is that judge who was just mentioned, is a former Albany newspaperman whom O'Connell befriended to convince to quit journalism for a law degree. So he was started as a journalist, and he was convinced to go to law school and then be a judge because the boss told you to. So anyway, Bergen was awarded as a machine-backed judge whose career began in Albany Police Court in 1930 and ended in 1972. With his retirement after 9 years on the New York State Court of Appeals, the state's highest court. Bergen enjoyed a lifelong association with the O'Connells, particularly Dan and the Cornings, beginning with the mayor's father. Quote, their machine was as solid as any you'll find on the American political scene, Bergen said. It was a wondrous thing to behold. Wondrous. Well, it kept him on the bench. So many knew about Dan's cockfighting, but few knew Dan also raised fighting dogs. So said retired state Supreme Court Judge Edward Conway, born in 1917, whose father, John Conway, was a longtime friend of Dan's and his personal lawyer. Conway was also a Republican, but Dan made a rare exception that they remained friends as well as a client and attorney. The Conways lived in a big house in Cahoes. We'd raise chicks for Dan at our house and then bring them to Ravenna, where he had his cockfighting trainers. This is Edward. So he used to go to cockfights with Dan in Saratoga, and if a cock was killed, Dan would give my brother the fetters to make trout flies. Dan helped us out in any way he could. I remember when our dog was killed by the neighbor's German shepherd. Dan gave us a pit bull from among his fighting dogs. It was named Coolidge after the president. That pit bull tore up that guy's German shepherd, but it also killed about 5 other dogs in the neighborhood in 3 days, and my dad had to bring the pit bull back to Dan. Whew. Those are the days, right? Miss him? Dan was sorry he couldn't keep it, and later gave us an Irish setter. For a young boy like Erasmus Coring II, this is the one who's the mayor, who realized only that shadowy politicos and fedoras showed up at the family's mansion with mysterious regularity, growing up with the machine must have seemed as commonplace as drawing breath. The mayor remembered his first meeting with Dan O'Connell at about age 5, a hazy boyhood memory he shared with John Tirafani. I'm going to skip that. It doesn't matter. In an undated reminiscence typewritten and saved in his personal papers, Coring wrote, at the start of World War I, when I was a small boy, the family moved from Chestnut Street to a big brownstone on Washington Avenue next to the Thatcher House, and almost across from the Fort Orange Club. So this is where the Firefighters Association headquarters is now, or Commerce Plaza, one or the other. One day, my father told me he was going to have some Democrats come over to the house that afternoon, and he would like me to meet some. I waited around all day, and while a lot of people came and went, I didn't see any Democrats, and asked him about it afterwards. He told me that all the people were the Democrats, which was a surprise to me. But in the year succeeding, I found that statement to be true. What a simple man. This is something for out the Corning biography. Despite being exceptionally educated as a patrician, you know, this is upper crust incarnate. Devilishly simple as far as like mindset and worldview and how he thinks about things. Like when asked, why are you mayor? Usually like you could take that question as like, what's your vision for the city? Like, I have big plans. No, his answer is, I like being mayor. And a similar question about like how the machine works. Well, I like doing business with my friends. It's as simple as that. So keep your hackamamie political theories to yourself, It just comes down to, you know, people just being themselves and being whatever. It's like, okay. Meanwhile, the city's burning down or rotting out slowly. But that's the last chapter. Not skipping to the end, right? The Cornings had deep pockets, and they helped finance the establishment of the countywide Democratic Party political organization that culminated in Dan's 1919 victory in the race for Albany assessor. The assessor's office is where it all starts. But, so I'm just going back here, you know, you can have the social network, but if you're going to get political office, you still need to be funded, right? Political power in a capitalist society is money. You still need money. You can have all the friends you want, but unless some of those friends have deep pockets, as this says, you're not really going to get anything as far as politics or power or business is concerned. So the assessor's position was the only elected office that Dan O'Connell ever held. And this is he was just back from World War I, where he served in the U.S. Navy aboard the Prairie for a 2-year tour of duty beginning in June 1917. Dan appeared in gaudy campaign banners wearing his sailor's uniform and depicted as a patriotic veteran and Democrat who captured the attention of an apathetic electorate. O'Connell's unexpected win exposed a chink in the protective armor of then Albany's long-entrenched Republican machine. Oh, would you know it? Albany once had a Republican machine, at least for 30 years. And this is that of the William Billy Barnes, grandson of influential newspaper publisher Thurlow Barnes. Someone was actually at the Albany Rural Cemetery, and they took a picture. And there, wouldn't you know it, the picture had the one of the big monuments there has the word Barnes on it. That's one of the Albany Rural Cemetery's big obelisks, Barnes. There it is. Okay. So they built something with their name on it. Well, that's the thing. You know, speaking as a humanist, if you want to put your name on something so you're remembered, I would think it should be more than just your headstone. Okay. But that maybe I'm getting morbid there. So the Barnes wealth came from the newspaper business, and his grandson was the political boss of the Republican machine before the O'Connells. This is before the end of World War I. He was called the boy leader, also Harvard trained, although Corning wasn't, but Groton might as well have been. But he was Harvard trained, another patrician, who had become owner of two Albany newspapers and had seized control of city politics in the 1890s, so about 30 years. With Dan's election, in cockfighting parlance, the O'Connells and Cornings smelled blood, strapped on a slasher, and went in for the kill, capturing City Hall in 1921 with their first candidate, William Stormont Hackett. Yes, the middle school and the avenue. That Hackett. A banker friend of Edwin and Parker Cornings. Banker. Dan borrowed a page from Tammany Hall boss George Washington Plunkett, whose political philosophy could be summed up in a sentence. I seen my opportunities and I took them. That's something taken from his called Honest Graft. And I will read it on this program Sunday as a, an accessory reading, you know. In Hackett, the Cornings and O'Connells shared the WASP aristocratic mayoral mold, continued for the next six decades by John Bird Thatcher and then Erasmus Corning. The strategy was to have Irish Catholics in the background operating the gears of the machine and a Protestant titular head out front handling public relations and official duties in City Hall. A ribbon cutter par excellence with patrician breeding and excellent diction. It was respectability they were after. Respectability politics, very old. And Hackett filled the bill. A man who invented himself as an aristocrat, despite the fact he was Baptist. Apparently that's a That's a no-no. And a member of his mother's church. Emmanuel Baptist in Albany, who came from a Scottish and Irish lineage. Okay, so he's not actually from WASP heritage, not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. He is from those Dark Isles. But he, I guess, educated himself enough to be one and be a banker. He was born in 1866. Hackett grew up on Ferry Street in Albany, South End, which was O'Connell Turf. The South End against the world was the neighborhood slogan, a fierce pride and loyalty of tribe engendered by the O'Connells. Hackett dropped out of Albany High School after 2 years at age 16, but his intelligence and drive won him a job as a law clerk. Hackett eventually moved into banking, working his way from assistant treasurer at the Albany City Savings Institution. That's that building at the corner of Pearl and State. Corning's Bank, which was also Corning's Bank, and the place the patricians piled their wealth. Hackett served as a reservist in the Army from 1890 to 99 as a sergeant with Company A. With the attack of the battleship Maine in the harbor of Havana, Cuba, and the outbreak of the Spanish-American War in February, 32-year-old Hackett was called to the front, request to report, but he didn't make it. Why? A memorial booklet later published about Hackett by the Cornings and his banking cronies recounted how, on the evening of April 26 of 1898, that when called upon to fight in the war, Hackett rose, said, "I greatly regret I cannot," and then broke down. On many occasions afterwards, Hackett expressed his great regret that on the one occasion that he had the opportunity to serve his country as a soldier, he chose not to go and fight. It's weird. Wasn't he a reservist? How did he have a choice? Was it because he was rich enough? Anyway, so a strong lesson was learned from Hackett's experience. Wartime service became a benchmark of the machine. Dan O'Connell parlayed his World War I Navy career of 2 years into elected office, and Mayor Rasmus Corning was reelected in the largest landslide in history, or in his career, because he served as a GI during World War II for 2 years. One of the first lawyers drafted in Albany came to know his unwritten military service policy firsthand. His name was Harvey Lifesett. Lifesett became a major of the Army's 82nd Airborne and was awarded 5 combat medals during the Battle of the Bulge. Lifesett returned to a prosperous law practice after the war and decided to enter politics in 1956. He met with O'Connell at Whitehall Road. His house is 142 Whitehall, which I keep trying to look at, find a picture of. I've walked by it bunch. I know it's basically the block next to Ash. Dan already had the scouting report on Lysette, who spoke little during the brief meeting. Dan said he had the winning combination of lawyer and war record was an unbeatable combination for a candidate. Dan then gave me his blessing. Then Dan said it was a go. He was then elected to state assembly and served 6 terms. Was there any, you know, policy? Was there any vision or ideology? Nope. He just wanted to get into politics. And it's like, well, you're a lawyer. You're a vet. All right, you're going to win. There it is. Foreign war zones had a strangely powerful impact on the arc of Albany politics. Even though he always regretted he didn't fight in Havana, Cuba. By the way, this is just weird. So a fun little story here. Hackett made a trip. He's the mayor. But he made a trip during peacetime in 1926. Hackett was at the height of his popularity and zenith of his political career. Some insiders believe Governor Al Smith, positioning himself for a run for president in 28, had tapped Hackett as his replacement candidate for governor in the year when he campaigned for the White House. What happened? Well, Hackett went to Havana in 1926, seeking the therapy of a tropical climate for an unspecified health problem. The car Hackett, and also, I guess, cause, you know, he regretted not fighting there. So the car Hackett was riding in hit a bumpy patch. He lost control and was killed. Edwin and Parker Corning, and that's it on Hackett. Edwin and Parker Corning organized a tribute to Hackett, publishing the commemorative booklet, A Loyal and Well-Beloved Son of Albany. And they offered a memorial service on March 5th, 1926, at a special meeting of the Board of Trustees for the City Savings Bank of Albany. The board members read like a who's who of Albany ruling families, so keep these names in mind. Parker Corning, Jacob Herzog, Peter ten Eyck, James Cox, George Thatcher, Samuel Hesburgh, Anthony Bradley Farrell, and Thomas Hunn. The machine's aristocratic wing had groomed one of its own to succeed Hackett after his death. The next mayor was thus John Boyd Thatcher II, a Princeton man and an excellent orator who matched the WASP City Hall frontman prerequisite. Thatcher had money and had managed well the purse strings as the machine's controller, beginning in 1921, and later was promoted to president of the Common Council. Hackett's grandfather and great-grandfather had been Albany mayors as well, like Corning's great-grandfather. All the same people, all the same. We'll see that trend continue. We'll see. Yeah. From the beginning, the O'Connell-Corning machine was something of a secret society. There that is again. Another accessory reading I will do or think about doing is a book, a shorter book that I've recently published called Anarchism and the Occult. And like most books that I buy, I read the first chapter first and maybe put it down or decide them, you know, when. It's how I decide what order I read things, you know, get a sense of a book. And the first chapter was sort of about a leftist in Occupy, like myself, kind of in these discussion groups. And conspiracy theories would come up. Someone who was just certain that the Jews were behind 9/11 or something like that. And this academic leftist wanted to look into this. You know, why is conspiracy theories, why are they a thing on the left in the first place? And kind of going into the development of the bourgeois capitalism in the world is also the development of these secret societies, the Masons, the Elks, the the Lions, the social clubs, and here in Albany, the Fort Orange Club. These clubs are, if not, they're not literal, they're either the drivers of economic control in a locality, and it's when, in this case, when when it's a political version, it's a machine. Now I'll read on. So from the beginning, the O'Connell-Corning machine was something of a secret society. These men understood how much seemingly inscrutable organizations worked. They knew it from the illegal cockfighting network. They knew it from secretive fraternal groups like the Knights of Columbus or the Masons, to which many of the machine operatives also belonged. They knew it from secret societies at their Ivy League schools, such as the Corning Allegiance to the Wolf's Head. They knew it from members-only social venues ranging from the Fort Orange Club to the Elks. The rules of each of these clubs hinged on certain principles. Undemocratic principles, I may add. But the first rule was exclusivity. Membership was only to the chosen few. The second rule was loyalty. You were expected to stick together and help out a fellow member in need, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, like a marriage of sorts. The third rule was unity. You pooled resources and energies to defeat all challenges to your dominance. The fourth rule was then confidentiality. You told nobody about what went on inside the club and were expected to take its secrets with you to the grave. So, when it comes to, and this is an aside, so much is unwritten about how our economy is actually run. Because what we get in the textbooks is the show and the dance of the front man. The patrician Protestant mayor of Albany is the front man, and then there's the secret society of underlings and infrastructure, and they're just doing all sorts of things. But they're also churchmen, and they're also the money, you know, they take a little bit from the from the coffers of government, they skim a little bit off and they give it to the churches. And so the churchmen are on their side. But this book doesn't go into that. I'll need to read the machine book to see if that does. But it could be said that Albany is the only place where the mob, the government, and the church were all run by the same people. So with the waning minutes of my hour, definitely not. This is going to be a multi-part series. Because I'm only a fraction into this. So let's review that, though. The rules of the secret society / the social clubs of the elite. The elitists. Those shadowy elitists. They. The globalists. the Jewish cabal, whatever form it takes in the minds of the paranoid. But it is not just paranoia. There really are exclusive private clubs where confidentiality and loyalty, and it's collective, they pool their resources. It's a conspiracy. It's not so much a conspiracy against everybody else, though it is one for dominance. Dominance in the marketplace, of their families, of prestige. And that takes the form of local politics, of course, and the national as well. But, of course, that's what, you know, regional politics is then just the competition between the local clubs. And then it just rises and it just keeps going up and up and up until you're at the global level, where it's royal families and their associates. But that's sort of the occultish kind of view of world history, right? And again, it's all unwritten. So what proof really is there? Only the hearsay and the secondhand, you know, descriptions of how all these things work, which is why it was, I look forward to reading the book on the Albany Machine in full. But I like this as because it's just one chapter, even though it's going to take me probably at least three episodes to go through. But it's the first rule is exclusivity. It's for the, you know, an elite. We're the chosen few. It's even if it's, you know, even though, I mean, it's still based on meritocratic ideas. That's why I'll bash meritocracy, too, because all these guys are like, well, we're the best educated. We have the most merit. We have we've been doing a good job at what we do. You know, it's why we're rewarded. We climb the ranks because we do a good job. We take orders and so on and so forth. And you can kind of turn it into something a little more empowering to think that, look, all it takes to change the world is a conspiracy of you and your friends. You just have to act like these social clubs. Have unity. Pool your resources. I don't see that enough. I can see it with what you have left over, right? You know, like the stuff you buy, like the buy nothing groups are kind of pooling resources, mutual aid. It's, oh, I have extra. But you're not pooling all your resources. Like that would be an income sharing commune or something. But we don't really share incomes. You know, we still think of it as my income. I have to take care of myself and pay my rent. But that's because, you know, when you're working class, you're just worried about yourself or just meeting you and it's you and your family. At least that's the narrative. Building block of society is the family, right? But that's not really how it is. It's these communities. That's the building block. So exclusivity, loyalty, unity, and then confidentiality. So that's at least something to work with and how things work. Okay, I'm in the last minute here, so I'm going to wrap up the show. I'm only 10 pages in, and there's 30 more to, well, anyway. Two more episodes away, and I hope I've whetted your interest and look forward to the next reading in this at least three-part reading series. We'll see how it goes. I may bring in those accessory readings, Honest Graft, which I have in another book of a compendium, and maybe that first chapter of the Anarchism and the Occult about secret societies and the role in history and thinking about politics. So anyway, this has been What's Left in Albany. I've been your host, Dan Platt, and I encourage you all to join an organization, start a secret society of your own. I think it's the least we can do in these challenging times, and make some trouble and find what's left here in Albany.
thing as America anymore. Just rich people and poor people.